tell us how it has most of it. It's going to be the site's hello. There are many ways to look at the subject, you know, as part of a more of a national and philosophical standpoint. Our Hukama, they've stressed a lot on the issue of justice. Justice is probably an incorrect, inaccurate translation of the word adalat, yaktadalat, which is to have a balance in yourself and balance outside. Now, balance in the sense that everyone has his rightful place. In a society, everyone should occupy the space according to one's ability and merit. A society that allows people, you know, their proper place that they deserve is a just society. The same way you, inside of you, allow everything that God has given you to give it a proper place inside.
One thing should not overpower another thing. You know, one thing, one person in a society should not occupy more than its place at the expense of another person. Right? If you're a doctor, you need to act and work like a doctor. If you take a place that someone else is more suited for, then this is, you know, injustice. Or if you are not allowed proper place to work as a doctor, then this is injustice to you. Now, to a large extent within the US, to some extent, large extent, I don't know exactly how much, there is a good sense that people get what they work for. For example, they work hard, they find a job that they qualify for. If you're an IT professional, you work hard, you find a job that you can do. So this is what we are referring to. If there's justice, to whatever extent a society, you know, accepts, encourages justice, that society, that government will become more and more powerful and will exert more influence on other people. Whether U.S. promotes, United States promotes justice outside of U.S. is a different story. But within itself, to a large extent, allow people to basically enjoy the fruits of their labor. Let's put it this way. It's not perfect, and there's a lot more to this discussion as well. Wall Street and politicians and big business, what they do in politics and how they use the media and exploit everything and sell war to the people and all kinds of things. I'm not referring to anything more than the basic concept. Around the world, there's a lot of injustice. Let's say countries you find where people do not get what they are worked hard for. So, like in Pakistan, for instance, Bahrain, other places, the number of countries where this is happening, people work hard, they're either discriminated against, right? They're targeted, basically eliminated, or because of other things, Arab, non-Arab, Iranian, non-Iranian, whatever may the case be, in whatever country they live in, right? Provincialism, right? Bias. So we have faced a lot of challenges because of that in other countries. War. War is another problem. Huge, huge problem. Saudi Arabia has invaded Yemen. Yemen is resisting, but the loss of life, destruction of infrastructure, all of that. Invasion of Syria and Iraq and Afghanistan and many other places. Similar thing. So the, morally speaking, if a person does not acquire the quality of adalat inside, right, it lacks a lot. There's a huge problem, deficit, personality deficit. A person who is not just inside is encountering a huge deficit. There's no way to put something in its place. Just as you must have hikmat, that means you should have good knowledge of how things are, what they are. You must also have a good sense of balance inside you. But because of the social norms sometimes, for example, promoting selfishness, right? And something in the name of self-esteem, like a pronounced form of self-esteem, which is like ego. And lack of empathy, which is the product of byproduct of competition. When you have too much competition in anything, people start ignoring how, you know, their success leads to the suffering of other people. A politician wins an election, makes all the promises, and doesn't care about what happens after. Obama got elected, then he disappeared, to be found next election when he had to run another campaign. This is a typical case of when you have basketball players, your kids playing basketball, and their whole concern is about winning that game, right? Or a student wants to be the first in class, doesn't care about other students, how he can help others as well who need some guidance, help, tutoring probably. People stop caring. In any environment when there's too much competition, people stop caring. And competition in material things. If the competition was about taqwa, about spiritual things, who is a better person? Can I be a better person? Well, obviously you'll be caring more for other people in order to be a better person, not less. But if you want more money, chances are that you will be acquiring that money, you know, causing others harm, like greed in any profession. Even in religious profession, if greed comes, you know, becomes that, then you basically, you find ways to make more money, right? And at the detriment of other people, right? Please recite a salawat. As-salamu alaykum wa rahmatullah. MashaAllah. So I have, I think, just a few more minutes. I think what we need to be doing is going forward. If this Muslim Congress wants to become more relevant in United States, it needs to start building bridges and common ground with others in this society who work for humanity, right? You may even want to have forums where it's not labeled as a religious event, you know, necessarily, an event where you explore how on serious subjects of human life and wellness, for example, preventing wars, supporting oppressed people, how people can come together on that major issue of justice, which I said is paramount. It's the highest human virtue is justice. If you sift through all the books of philosophy, morality, you end up with one result. The highest supreme human virtue is justice. You know very well that the object, the aim, the goal of the zuhur of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salatu wasalam, Allahumma salam, is just that. His mission is justice. When he completes that mission, justice established in this world, then there are other missions assigned to other imams who will come after Imam Zaman alayhi salam, who will bring, you know, more profound things than justice. But without justice, you cannot achieve anything beyond justice, depends on justice basically. For example, khulus, iman, right? Sincerity, ma'rifat of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Or even material things, a society wants to prosper, has to have some level of justice. That's why US has prospered so far, because of some level of justice it offered. Now, it's debatable, was it more before than now, or whatever be the case, if they had not allowed this much justice, the level that we have right now, it would not have become what it has become. And for any society to be strong, it has to first implement justice internally. So we have to build bridges, and building bridges means that we should be strong advocates of justice. Put that on the top. When you do that, you will see that people come together and there will be discourse, there will be a lot of debate, because people will have different opinions about different things which we may not even agree with. But that issue of justice should first be supreme. Caring about other parts of the world is very important. I'm from Pakistan, I just take two more minutes, that because of the shift in policy that the dictator Ziaul-Haq introduced in Pakistan, to basically turn the minority into a majority, to be put them on top helm of power, which is a Deobandi Takfiri, the Takfiri, you know, mentality. Deoband was a school which promoted and still promotes the same ideology. They were originally against the creation of Pakistan. They thought others are kafirs. Only their brand of Islam is right and everybody else is wrong. Ziaul-Haq put that in place. Intolerance, hate, everything. He wanted to basically suppress the voice of the majority, the Shia voice, the Barelvi, Sufi and others. And current crisis in Pakistan is a result of that. The current struggle of our people in Pakistan and ulama, right, is to reverse the policies of Ziaul-Haq, reverse policy shift, which is not an easy thing to do after 30 years. 30 years, 80,000 people killed, thousands of people leaving Pakistan, professionals, medical professionals, intellectuals, businessmen. Destruction of city of Karachi, turning it into a basically economic slum, all of that, the biggest city of Pakistan, all of that was a result of the policies of Ziaul-Haq. To bring that change back to the way, reason why Pakistan was founded is not going to be easy. But this is a struggle we have to do. Other places, we have similar stories. But today what we are seeing is that there is a hukumat in place, right? Not the hukumat and government that we usually think in terms of the word government, but a spiritual government of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salatu wasalam, Allahumma salli ala Muhammad. Against this, the evil government of Satan and Iblis. So we have the spiritual government of Imam Akhiruz-Zaman, who has its devoted and sincere followers and agents and, you know, representatives who are working today. Iblis and satanic forces have their own powers and agents who do their dirty job for Iblis. And this has been the case since the time of Adam alayhi salam, since the zuhur of Imam alayhi salam and beyond that, until Imam Ali alayhi salam puts an end to that evil government of Iblis once and for all. Before the judgment day, Imam Ali alayhi salam will put an end to that. We're working towards that. And it's all manifestations of these both of these powers, spiritual government and the evil satanic government. And it's now hadith of Raj'at and Zuhur and all, we have enormous amount of literature in that, in the hadith of the Holy Prophet and Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala make us agents of the spiritual government of Imam Akhiruz-Zaman alayhi salam, so that we can pave the way for adalat on the face of this earth, inshallah. Sallallahu ala Muhammadin wa ala tari.
Thank you, Maulana, and he has done an excellent job extemporously. I just told him 2 minutes ago, because the other sheikh had to go to a funeral, and he helped us out. He was talking about building bridges, not walls. And it is my honor and privilege and pleasure to welcome a political activist, human rights activist. We all saw in the DNC that Brother Khizr Khan came up with the book of the US Constitution, and for a fallen soldier, for an illegal war, he talked about the Constitution. But what the likes of Khizr Khan doesn't realize is that the US Constitution today is dead on code blue. And while the US Constitution was on code blue, a nice Jewish young girl from Long Island came up with the idea of reviving the United States with a code pink. She also came up with the Global Exchange, which is a human rights organization, and she is starting a pink revolution with, behind the US-Saudi connection, the kingdom of the unjust. So after the session, she will sign copies to it. So with shalom and salam, we welcome Sister Mary Benjamin. We call it, thank you.
Thank you so much for this invitation to speak before you. I arrived last night and have had some wonderful conversations last night and this morning, learning about your community, but I must profess a large degree of ignorance, so excuse me if I say anything offensive or I don't express a full understanding. I think I know a lot more than probably 90% of Americans about the Muslim community, but that's not saying too much. And I think that so much of the Islamophobia that we are now seeing in this country stems from ignorance. Ignorance of what Islam is about. Some of it spread to malign Islam as being a religion of violence, and some of it just coming out of a fear of the other. And we know that, as Bernie Sanders made so clear in his campaign, this is an economy where the small percentage of billionaires and multimillionaires are making out quite well. It is a time when a lot of middle-class Americans are not. And for the white middle class, especially the male white middle class, it's a time when they see their privileges are diminishing. And so, unfortunately, there is a tendency towards blaming the other. Blaming the other can be blaming the Latino immigrant community. And look at that community, we would not have food on our table were it not for that community that picks our food, that takes care of our children, that takes care of our elders, but such a backlash now against that community. Also a backlash against the black community, something that's been going on since the founding of this nation based on slavery, but we see it more and more today. And then there is the backlash against the Muslim community. And it fits in this narrative post 9/11 and the indiscriminate terrorist attacks that have been happening in the United States, in Europe, and of course throughout the Middle East. But this narrative fits nicely into a white, hatred, xenophobic narrative that Donald Trump has picked up on. And I think is becoming increasingly dangerous in this country. There was a time that maybe we could laugh at how silly he is and so many of his statements being ridiculous. But there is a fine line between the ridiculous and the dangerous, and I think he has crossed that path. when he says that Muslims should not be allowed in this country, it's as if there are not so many Muslims already who are part of this country. And this is a country made up of so much diversity. I think it was very sad to see the kind of statements that were coming out at the Republican convention, and very interesting because so much of the Muslim community is a conservative community that probably overlaps in a lot of the social values with the Republican Party. But now this distance that that Trump has created, it's funny because he is barely a Republican himself, but created this rift in the Republican Party with so much of the Muslim community. But then you look at the Democratic Party. The fascinating response around the Khan family. I think on one level, it is beautiful to see a Muslim that is so well received by so much of the American public, but so sad that it has to be because they sacrificed their son in a war that should never have happened, and in a war that has pitted Muslims against Muslims, in a war that has had such disastrous consequences, not only for the Muslim community, but for the entire world. And here it is, this family of a deceased soldier that now becomes emblematic of the good Muslim. There are other, I think, disturbing things within the Democratic Party itself around issues that we probably all in this room care about, and does feed into the Islamophobia. I don't know if any of you picked up on the speech of Bill Clinton himself, but I just want to read a quote from there, which for most Americans was probably taken favorably. If you are a Muslim and you love America and freedom and hate terror, stay here. We want you. I don't know how you interpret that, and I am not a Muslim, but I am offended by that. I find the implications there saying that you are not real Americans. You are here temporarily. And if you can prove to us, the real Americans who are the non-Muslims, that indeed you love this country and you hate terror, then you are welcome to stay here. I think we should say to Bill Clinton that Muslims are indeed Americans who live here, and they do not have to prove their patriotism. It should be assumed that the Muslims living here are as patriotic as anybody else living in this country. It feeds into this idea that the acts of individual, mostly crazy individuals who happen to be Muslim, and the workings of a terrorist group like ISIS that happens to be birthed out of the U.S. invasion of Iraq as well as the nation of Saudi Arabia, is somehow indicative of the billion plus Muslims that live in this world. It is the same as saying that the workings of the Ku Klux Klan in this country somehow represent Christianity, or that the right-wing Israeli government of Netanyahu somehow is the teachings of the Jewish community. And as somebody from the Jewish community, I find that offensive because I do not think the teachings of the Jewish community are reflected by the right-wing government of Israel. So, when we see the policies of Islamophobia, I think it is rooted in the policies of racism. You might distinguish yourselves in this community as Shia, differencing yourselves from Sunni, and certainly from other communities like Buddhists or Sikhs. But for the majority of Americans, they don't know the difference. You are all one community and suffer the same kind of Islamophobia. And that is why I think even President Obama, who is seen by many as a peace president and even won a Nobel Peace Prize, and certainly is lauded for being the first black president, has relied on racism against the Muslim community for a lot of his policies. Here you have a Nobel Peace Prize winner that has bombed 7 Muslim countries, that is responsible for the killing of thousands of innocent Muslim people. And the drone warfare that I wrote a book about, calling Drone Warfare Killing by Remote Control, is only possible because of the racism and the Islamophobia and the lack of understanding in this country that every single life is precious, and that the life of a Muslim living in Pakistan, in the tribal areas, is as precious as the lives of anybody living in this country. So we have to understand that racism is so deeply embedded in this country and allows for policies that are wrong internally and allows for policies that are wrong in our foreign policy. I recently just released a book on Saudi Arabia because I think it is so important that we focus attention on really the country in the Arab world that is most responsible for the spread of extremism and for the distortion of what is a peaceful religion, and that is indeed Saudi Arabia. And how ironic is it that this is the great U.S. ally in the region? This is the Saudi nation that so violates the basic principles of freedom of religion. And one would think that a nation that calls itself an Islamic country would be sensitive to the rights of the minority Shia community. But indeed, the Shia community in Saudi Arabia is discriminated against by the state itself. The Shia community that lives in the oil-rich part of the country is the poorest part of the community. The Shia community that sees the Sunni government building these magnificent mosques, not only in Saudi Arabia but all over the world, does not get government money to build Shia mosques, and instead faces daily discrimination. It's interesting talking to some of my friends here, like Ali Muzvis, who is in the audience, about the pain that the Shia community around the world felt with the killing of Sheikh Nimr, and how much of the activism now is coming out of that, and that is so important. And so important, I think, that we join forces to not only show how the Saudi government is executing non-violent members of the Shia community only because they are standing up for their rights, but also reflecting the violence of that country in general, the way it has invaded Bahrain to crush the uprising there of the majority Shia community in the wake of the Arab Spring, and the way they are daily involved now in the bombing of Yemen and the killing of thousands of people and the creating of a humanitarian crisis that is, in terms of the refugees, even bigger than the humanitarian crisis in Syria. But we don't hear about it at all. The fact that there are now 21 million people in Yemen who rely or need international humanitarian aid to survive is something that the American people barely know about it, and certainly don't know the role that the United States itself is playing by not only supporting Saudi Arabia, but providing the weapons and providing the logistical assistance to the massacre that is going on in Yemen, to the war crimes that are being committed there. So there is so much that we have to unravel in terms of U.S. foreign policy, U.S. support for repressive regimes overseas, U.S. support for the Israeli government, and how we have to build a new movement to address these issues. I have the opportunity to be speaking in the town hall meeting at 2:45, and we'll get into more detail about what we can do to address these issues. But I just want to end by saying that on the one hand, we have a really terrible election that we are facing with two candidates who are disliked by so many people in this country and two candidates that are so deeply flawed. Some of us are looking towards third parties, whether it's the Green Party or the Libertarian Party, for people that we feel more comfortable voting with. But let's face it, given our system, neither third parties will not win the election, which means that no matter which party wins, we will have somebody even more problematic in the White House than we have had in the past. And the only silver lining in this is that we need each other. The only silver lining in that is that it's going to force us to open ourselves up to new communities, to working differently, to connecting our issues. Some of us, if I could see a show of hands of people who were inspired by Bernie Sanders, could you raise your hands? Quite interesting that in your community he was seen as a figure who represented justice, who represented the need for a just economic system, who represented the positive moral values that we hold dear. And here he was a Jew. And here he was a person who has taken on the issue of Palestine that no other mainstream candidate would dare even mention, that he talked about the need for justice for the Palestinians, that he stood up against the incredibly strong lobby group AIPAC, is quite remarkable and has opened up a new space in mainstream politics in which we have to enter that space in a big way, given the strong connections that Hillary Clinton has to the not only to AIPAC but to the right-wing Israeli government. I think that Bernie Sanders has also brought new energy into the social justice movement, brought a new generation of young people into this movement, and this is something for us to be inspired by and something for us to build on. Unfortunately, during the campaign, key issues did not arise, such as the need to cut the enormous Pentagon budget that is taking money away from really needed issues like health care for all, like free college education, like addressing the climate crisis. So we need to start educating and mobilizing about the need to shift money from the militarist stance into one of a peace economy. So I look forward to talking with you all more in the afternoon session, but more important than that, I look forward to working with you all more in the years ahead as we're building the kind of justice at home as well as a foreign policy that reflects the moral values that we have as a community. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. The next speaker does not need any introduction. Sheikh Abdul Ali Musa, born as Clarence Reams in Arkansas, is a Muslim activist and a public speaker, is a director of Masjid al-Islam in Washington, D.C., where the main action is as far as activism is concerned. And we have seen Maria all the time in the halls of Congress with her pink. But he is very tall indeed in his actions too. He's a member of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought and a director of Al-Sabiqoon. And the challenge for me is to keep him within the time limit. I do know a little bit of karate, so I'll use that.
I'll cooperate.
So, please, with a loud salawat, and after the speeches are done, we will have chances for question and answer, and we have a volunteer both in the men's side as well as the women's side who will so look up for a good session at the end of this. Thank you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillah. Alhamdulillah. Ahmaduhu wa astainuhu wa astadihi wa astaghfiruhu wa umminu bihi jalla wa ala wa la akfuruhu wa ashadu wa la ilaha illallah wa ashadu anna muhammadan abduhu wa rasuluhu. As-salahu bil huda wa deen al-haq li yadhiruhu ala deen kulihi wa lao kariha al-mushrikun. Dear brothers and sisters, since time is short, I'm going to go directly to the point, inshallah. First of all, I would like to thank our sister, a whole lot. Tell the truth. Just go back 30 years, 25 years ago. Remember all the struggle and the pain we went through to tell people who the Wahhabis are, who's Saudi Arabia, all the fitna that they're doing, right? And now look, we get up here, it just warms my heart. I don't know how it make you feel, but when she even got a book on Saudi Arabia. And who in the American society knew anything about Bahrain, the eastern provinces, Qatif and all of those areas? I'm telling you, we're living in a different world. And that's the world that I want to talk to you about briefly. First of all, I'm going to go back to what we recognize as our recent beginning, the Islamic Revolution in Iran. First of all, I'd like to say is that the revolution have exceeded all expectations. The revolution in Iran has exceeded all expectations. From the chants, Marg Bag America, death to America, right? In those days, America was still a prominent force in the globe. In fact, it commanded a lot of the direction of not only Europe, but most of the world. Then after the fall of the Soviet Union, it had a brief period where it was a unipolar system going on in the world. So, death to America. American economy, America's power, America's prestige, American honor, and America's word is dead. Dead as a doornail. So death to America has happened. Now remember, we never meant death to the American people. All of us know that, but the American people don't know that. Now we got to bring the American people up to speed on a lot of issues. The next export of the revolution. Y'all remember that? Export of the revolution. Dear brothers and sisters, the revolution has been exported globally. It's been exported worldwide. We live in a different world. In those days, Iran had to fight the war and every other issue all by itself. Iran was one country by itself. There was only one country in the world that gave it a little tentative support, and that was Syria. That's why the people of the world don't understand why Iran is not going to let Syria go down, right? Hezbollah is not going to allow Syria to go down. Why? Because during that fight with all of the so-called Arabs and every other configuration of humanity, all on Saddam's side, and Iran had to fight an 8-year war with no help from nobody, with sanctions, boycotts. This is a modern miracle. Iran, as an example, I spoke a few months back in Iran, and some people were complaining about a few things. They would say, you talk about we have this and we have that. You're more Iranian than we are. I said, so. You have so much freedom there. I said, we have freedom in America? I said, that's right. I didn't go into nothing about, how we might be treated, how many times personally I've been arrested and jumped on. I have a little something. Somebody sent me this from it was on the internet. It says, revolution from Egypt to the Americas, right? That's what it says. Then it has Imam Jamil Alameen. Y'all know H-Rap Brown from the old days. A friend of mine. You know H-Rap Brown from the revolutionary days, Burn, Baby Burn. It was four prominent people in America during those days. Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Stokely Carmichael, and H-Rap Brown. Imam Jamil Alameen is H-Rap Brown. Then you have Imam Luqman. Those who are here in Detroit remember Imam Luqman was shot either 21 times or 18 times or something while he was on the ground right here in Detroit. Isn't that right? And then they have your dear Imam right here. This is me. You know what this poster means? This is a government poster. This means we got one of your homeboys. He's up here in prison for the rest of his life, right? Imam Jamil Alameen. They kept him in isolation for years, okay? Imam Luqman is dead, right? We done shot him down like a dog, and ain't nobody said a word about it. And you, nigga, if you keep running your mouth, you dead just like those two. That's what the poster mean. It takes a third grade education to understand the hierarchy. And what are they talking about? Revolution from Egypt to the Americas, Oakland and the Islamic Revolution. A lot of y'all have heard a lot about the fitna that we've had in Oakland, right? All kind of fitna. But here's what you don't understand. The fitna that we have in Oakland is that we are not the, call it, the, we are the target, but we are not victims of American oppression. We are now its predator. And it's going to take a long time for us to explain to you our process of evolution in the United States. We're different than Malcolm X. We're different than Dr. King. They were killed so quickly that they never had a chance to adjust to the American system, to adapt to the American system, to understand the habits, the behavior, and the customs. And they were not able to forecast and predict the behavior of the system. Therefore, they was not able to manipulate the system. But we've had over 35, 40 years. So we are predators. Us being alive here is proof. We are not victims of American. Oh, they beat you upside the head and drag you up and down. That to us is normal. In fact, we feel like that's great. The way they treat everybody else, a little beatings and stuff like that ain't nothing. Right? This is the way we look at it. Now, what's the main point here? Export of the revolution. This is very important. In the old days, we had Iran on one side, and everybody else was on the other side. But today we have what's called strategic alliance. Think about how important that is. On one side, you have Iraq. The strategic alliance comes from, is headquartered in Iraq. We have Iraq, Iran, Syria, and dear Russia. Remember Marg Barg Shoravi? Just think now, Daesh is being bombed by dear Putin. Dear Putin, not the godless Reds and commies anymore, right? Do you see how life has evolved? It's different. We're living in a different world. We're going to get to our situation in a minute. On the other side, we have Saudi Arabia, we have Egypt, we have Turkey. Turkey was doing so well a few years back, and then they just went crazy. I don't know what happened. Maybe they put a lot in the water, but they done gone crazy, right? And so you have a balance of forces now. You don't have everybody on one side against Iran and Iran all by itself. And guess what? In the media, who used to be the mean, worst people in the world? It was Iran. Now, who's the meanest people in the world? Saudi Arabia. Netanyahu, isn't that right? Just think, Iran now, and you can see, I see poor Javad is smiling so much, Zarif, I think he's going to have an operation to get his face back right. All you see, you know, he's a friend of mine, so he don't mind me making fun of him. He is grinning all the time, they might not have gained what they wanted from that 5+1 stuff, but look what they did gain. They neutralized the United States of America, and they ran Saudi Arabia crazy. You got to understand what's going on. If you're trying to figure out why is Saudi Arabia in a panic, why is Saudi Arabia going crazy? Why do their policy not make any sense at all? Why do they have a policy of suicide, right? You think about it. Saudi Arabia bought $1.5 billion in weapons last year, a year before last. They're buying the same amount this year. And their main export is oil. And they done dropped that this right around $40 a barrel right now, from $100 to $40 a barrel. They're spending money like going crazy, right? You probably heard about some of the Indian people and Pakistanis in Saudi Arabia, how they're rising up. They haven't been paid for a year. There's panic in Saudi Arabia. Why would Saudi Arabia have an incoherent policy? It is because they feel like the signs are there. America is getting ready to dump you, homeboy. You remember all of, y'all remember when the Shah was in Egypt, then he was here for a minute, then he went to Panama? You know who took care of the Shah in Panama? Security and everything? Manuel Noriega. But when he was of no use, what did they do? He's probably still over there in France somewhere in the penitentiary for selling American dope. Right? So this little friendliness, signal diplomacy between Iran, reminds Saudi Arabia of a historical precedent. After World War II, you had Germany and Japan. Germany and Japan were considered natural leaders in their environment. Therefore, they tried not to make the same mistake that they made in World War I, to crush Germany, to try to hold it down. Because if you did that, since Germany is a natural goose-stepping, power-hungry, you know, even if you're in Germany, when I was there, you still feel these big old white folks. Germany is not German, not these little old white folks you see everywhere else. Germans are militant. They're mechanical almost, right? So they're going to rise back up. So what did America do? The Marshall Plan, rebuild Germany, help Japan. Why? Because they're natural leaders. In the Middle East, they are natural leaders. There's one that is very prominent now. Right? Forget about the Mughal dynasty. Remember those dynasties? India. Forget about Uthmaniyya, the Ottoman Empire. But when they think about the Safavid dynasty, they think about Iran. They say Iran is the Persian Gulf, is a natural leader for thousands of years, for over 2,500 years. We read about, when we was reading about Darius and the writing on the walls and all of that in the Bible, it was talking about Daniel in the lion's den. That's in Persia, right? That's in Persia and Babylon, and they write that together, you know. So here's what I'm trying to say. Saudi Arabia feels a shift. And they feel like what they're hearing from Americans and everybody else is that the world is tired of kingships. They're tired of kingships. What does that mean? They're going to start talking about oh my goodness, some phony democracy in Saudi Arabia. That means these 5,000 princes and all of that gotta go. No more kingship, right? So that's why they have a policy of insanity. The most richest Arab country in the world bombing the poorest country, Yemen. Isn't that right? It's insanity. Spending all of that money, but flooding the world with oil, over 10 million barrels per day, maybe up to 12 or 14 now, to drop the oil prices. Right? A few people go, a couple of million people go to Hajj and thousands of people get killed. But 25 to 30 million people go to Karbala for Arabain and ain't nobody hurt, no, not even a fingernail scratch. Right? Something is going on, isn't that right? So, I know I don't have much time, but I'm going to try to reach the point here. So, the world has changed. The system of velayati faqih has proven itself. Under Imam, we had 10 years for it to develop. The Rahbar now has been there almost 30 years, about 28 years, right? As a stable leadership, and he has evolved and grown and developed. Right? So he would have to be considered an icon of Islamic leadership in the world. As far as things being so bad in Iran, I told him, okay, if things are so bad, if you think your house looked bad in the neighborhood, look at everybody else's house in the neighborhood. Right? So I said, you guys talking about we don't need velayati faqih, we need governmental system and president. I say, well, Pakistan got to look at Pakistan. They got presidents, so they got all of that stuff. I said, look at Afghanistan. That's another neighbor, right? You want to be like Afghanistan? Look at the Afghani house. It's no fault of their own, but I'm saying the people in Iran, some of the super rich are complaining. We need more. I said, good God Almighty. What, you already got three? Any of y'all been to Tehran lately? During the war, it wasn't hardly nothing happening. Since the war, it's hundreds of cranes all over Iran, building 20, 30, 40 story buildings all over. Isn't that right? In Tehran, we used to go to north, it used to be right here. Now it's way out there. Isn't that right? I'm trying to tell you that Iran has developed physically, it is developed in human development. So it exceeded all expectation. It survived as a good example. Now I want to get to the point about all of us here. Brothers and sisters, it's not a hidden fact of what's going on in the world today. Now, sometimes we have to understand what Allah's gifts are, how they come, and what we should do with those. In America, African Americans, of course, are a minority, but the civil rights movement energized people all over the world, and it also coincided with the decolonization movement all over the world. Right? So although we're a small minority here in America, the impact was huge on the Irish, on anybody you could think of, all over the world. And sympathy came in, hopes, dreams, and aspirations for freedom, liberation, and justice and equality came from here, from a minority. Now, in the world today, we can see what's going on. It's not only Bahrain, right? It's not only Hazaris in Afghanistan and Pakistan. It's not only daily bombings in Iraq, mainly all over the world. All of it funded and backed by Saudi Arabia. Isn't that right? Whether it's Boko Haram, it don't make no difference who it is. It's all aimed at the lovers of Ahlul Bayt. Isn't that right? Okay, this is going on relentless. Now, one thing about it, I'm very proud of Ahlul Bayt, how there has been very little violence in response to all of this mass murder, right? Believe it or not, that has affected the Muslim community, and it has also affected the non-Muslim community in the world. Because before, the Shias were these bloodthirsty Hezbollahis, bomb-toting everything, right? Now, the characteristic of the lovers of Ahlul Bayt, peace, transparency, and all of that is beginning to come out. But you have to wonder, why is this happening? Why is this happening? Do y'all remember about 5 years ago, I was talking here about the subject of the Shia community developing to a certain level? And I was saying it's crossover time. Do y'all remember that? Crossover, man, I used Michael Jackson. I said Michael Jackson stayed black, right? But he crossed over to where he was appealing to everybody. He had to appeal to everybody. He was on the news, and when he died, for 30 days, page one, and another 30 days for page two, right? So something was going on, and I said, don't worry, keep your dua kamil, keep all of that stuff, but now the world needs a certain type of leadership, global leadership. This is what Allah has handed the Shia community, but the Shia community is not thinking like that. I want you to look at it a minute. Bahrain, you don't have to worry about it. Bahrain has to go. 80% of the people are Shias. So eventually it has to topple, right? It has to. Whether it's a little violent sooner or later, it don't make no difference. You can't keep those bums at the top and the whole world is looking at them. Isn't that right? So Bahrain has to go the right way. The eastern province of Saudi Arabia, with the fitna that's going on, this is just our little pipe dream here, is that eventually they will, if Saudi Arabia is getting weaker, they'll just lop it off and say, this is Shia stand or something like that, right? Saudi Arabia will be too weak. They can't fight. You know they can't fight. They can't even whoop Yemen, and Yemen is poor and broke and don't have nothing, and they've been bombing it with super weapons and cluster bombs for over a year, and Yemen is still saying, you wait till next week, we're going to do this, and they are doing it. Saudi Arabia is a bunch of cowards. All the bombings and all the killings all around the world aimed at Shias. That is so that the Shia community is prepared for the next step in the evolution of the global Islamic movement. Nobody in the world is in the situation to lead the global Islamic revival except the Shia community. Nobody in the Arab world is even thinking about it, right? Nobody in the so-called Sunni world has any prestige. They have no system. They have nothing with that ability to do that. Isn't that right? And they don't have the credibility. Why is all the bombings and kill? When Allah puts you in a fight, He trains you for that fight. You know, and everybody else may seem like, oh man, they're finished. Like me, everybody look at me, they say, man, the government did this, the government did that. And they say, man, if the government did that to me, I would be finished. So people always coming up to me, are you all right, Imam Musa? Everything okay? I said, sure, I'm fine. Well, we heard, I said, you looking at me the way you would look at me if these things happened to you. Are you getting your time? Because I thought so. I can see on the side. I know what he's getting ready to do. I can see it. I'm going to wrap it up. Here's the thing. Brothers and sisters, during every period in history, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala prepares a people for his mission. And when you would look at Hajj and you would see thousands of people killed, and you look at, why do you think millions of people, I lost count the last one at 25 million, after Juma somebody said I think it's up to 28 or 30 million, right? At Kaaba. This, I don't have any idea. Why is that? It's called a collective consciousness. Do you notice that the more these bombings go on, the closer you feel, the more you love Ahlul Bayt, the more you, right? Tell the truth. So they're not doing you no harm. They think they are. They're doing you a favor. And the people know that the time is close. That's why 30 million people show up at Karbala for Arbaeen, and has nobody killed and nobody hurt at all. Isn't that right? So the Shia community is ready. And in the United States, dear believers, the party is over. Just because you came here for education, just because you came here for a job and all that, Allah, that, like a lot of people say, I tell people, Allah didn't bring me here to pick cotton. That was just part of the story. That I would come back to Islam after not even knowing nothing about Islam, being stripped of language, culture, and religion, and would come back to Islam because many of us were Muslims, so to do the job we're doing now. A lot of people wouldn't want to do the job that we're doing, facing the United States government face to face, telling them who they are, facing the Zionists with not even batting an eye and blinking. Why? Because that's our job. That's what Allah trained us for. And can't nobody burn it out of you? Can't nobody kill it? I tell the government, it's one thing you can do. You can shoot me in a bullet straight in the head. Other than that, you better get out of my face because ain't nothing else happening. And they know it's true. Okay, Shia community, Allah have placed you in this community, in this world, not only Iran, but the whole global Shia community, to develop the institutions to help guide the whole world in a purposeful way toward a new century of, call it global peace, all of that stuff. The last thing I'd like to say is, you visualize how you want things to be in America. You picture, they always talk about the American dream. What about your dream? You're not like 30 years ago. There are Shia centers, Imam Mahdi centers, Hosseinias all over America. There was a time when there was only one or two islands here in America. Now we have ulama all over America. Isn't that right? Okay. If you are 10% of the Muslim population, structured and organized, the better you're organized, the better you're developed, the more impact that you can have. And day by day, slowly but surely, the anti-fitna is going away, and it's going back to the ones that started it in the first place. Our sister's lecture was just a heartwarming situation. The last thing, this is the real last thing here. Is, you know, I get 6 or 7, sometimes 10 closes, and I'm ready to close an hour later, and I'm finally closing. So, brothers and sisters, it's always an honor and a privilege. Maybe I'll have some session late at night, tonight or tomorrow, because this stuff is complex. But I'd like to talk to you about what we have in world travel, being involved in detail with the Muslims around the world. This is the day and this is the time. This is it. This is it. The world needs you. The world needs your expertise, and Allah and handed it in your hand. Remember, this is the last thing. The Quran is clear. Allah does not waste the work or the life of a believer. Speak not of those who are slain in the way of Allah is dead, right? They're alive, but you don't know all of those martyrs. All of those are not, they're senseless killings as far as Saudi Arabia is concerned, but they mean something to us, isn't that right? And in order to honor those people, right here in America, if we do our job right, we can help the American people warm their hearts toward Islam. We can help Muslims all over the world. We can do a lot from here, right now. And we ask Allah to help us do that. Didn't mean to talk past the time. Thank you very much. Akula kali hada. Astaghfirullah li wa lakum. How's that? Reasonable?
Thank you very much. And we didn't even have to get to the lunch hour, so that's pretty good. So with two excellent speeches and Maulana Shamshad's excellent introduction, those who were here from the beginning, we can open up for some few questions if the volunteers are around with the mics. And if you can identify where you're coming from and to which speaker you have, and if the volunteers can give a mic, if they have one, for the speakers too? Or should I use this? Okay.
Yes. Assalamu alaikum. My name is Ali Hasib. I'm coming from Toronto, Canada. And my question is directed to Imam Musa Abdul Alim. I would like to say, Assalamu alaikum to respected scholars and brothers and sisters. All right. Somewhere in Islam, I had picked up on a hadith. It said that when Muslims migrate to a country, the first thing they should do is differentiate between the oppressed and the oppressors in that country. And the Muslims should align themselves with the oppressed. If that is true, did we do that, or are we doing that in America?
Okay. That's a very good question, and it's a long question. I mean, it's a long answer. There's different stages. I remember when we first met at that Toronto conference in 84, I think, at the that big center there, okay? That was my first encounter with it. The Muslims are not doing bad. The immigrant Muslims has been very mistreated in America. Let me put it this way. This is a very good question. Islam is the natural inheritor of the civil rights movement. Remember, we had Martin Luther King, civil rights, Malcolm X, black nationalism, then kind of Islamic. Then we had the BLA, Black Liberation Army, and we had all of those groups. And then by 1970 and 71, a transition happened that most of the survivors of those groups came into Islam, like Imam Jamil, Sunni Alakoda, all of those people, you know, became Muslims. So Islam is a natural inheritor of the civil rights movement. Now, In the old days, all the Islamic movements in America were mostly black. Starting from the old Nation of Islam days, and then all the Sunni Muslims, like the Dar al-Islam movement, the Islamic Party, were all heavy on the Sunnah, revolutionary, and they were militant. All of our movements were militant, right? All of our movements were very militant. During the late 70s and the early 80s and 90s, many of the Muslims from overseas began to populate in America. First, the MSA, Muslim Student Association. So, as the years went by, those little mosques and apartments around the universities began to expand into community centers. And now you have huge cathedral masajid all over America. And the prayer lines are so thick that it looks like Salatul Jummah at Maghrib prayer all over America. Okay? But in the meantime, the FBI and other groups always encourage the immigrants to stay away from African Americans. And they always did things to make it uncomfortable. I'll give you an example right here in Detroit. Do y'all remember when I gave a talk at Zanabia years ago, but I was arrested right where you go into the right? And they kept me there so everybody that would come out of Zanabia would see me being arrested. For no reason, they just let me go in 2 minutes. But everybody would say, hey man, it's dangerous to be around Imam Musa, so we may should stop inviting him because he's, you know, they gonna start asking us about immigration and all of that, and they may think he's a terrorist, then they think we're terrorists, right? No, this is systematic. This is systematic. So for the so-called Sunnis in the early days, man, it was wonderful. We were coming to Islam, and the brothers, especially from Pakistan, because the Arabs had it, if you don't learn Arabic, then you just finished. But since the Pakistanis and all that, first they were our brothers, then we started calling them doctor brothers. You know, like we was all brothers, we slept on the floor, did itikaf in the masjid. 10 years later, everybody's a doctor, so we call them now, for the last 25 years, doctor brothers. I'm answering the question.
Thank you.
No. This is important. You may not have been here last year and the year before last, but there were a group of African Americans going around like they did at many meetings. Some, they did the same thing in Toronto. And they would say, hey, we need to have a meeting because the brothers don't have no agenda about us, talking about African Americans. I told them, I'm not coming to that meeting. Because you here from America, you got to get yourself and get out and get busy. You should be helping them. They come here, they, the immigrants here, you should be the Ansar, right? You shouldn't be asking the people that come here to help you do something and you've been here for 500 years. This is my opinion. The other thing, those conferences, a lot of them were in Toronto. Remember those conferences? Imam always sent a representative. Remember, he usually wore a black turban. Imam always had a representative. Those representatives was there to help the movement develop. All the African Americans had to do was show unity. They wasn't there to help this group or that group. They were there to help all of us. And there were so many agent-type brothers amongst us that they always created fitna right in front of the ulama so it would look like that we were disorganized and disunified. There's so much fitna going on that we praise groups like this. They're doing good for the amount of fitna that's going on that they don't even know about. You have to give each group its time to feel its comfort zone. That's what the community is doing right now. Okay? When I say that, I mean the Shia community is doing that right now. Imam Khomeini said, go for the Mustadhafin. Remember that? Ask the Iranian brothers. Any Iranians here from way back? In every city that you was, any of the brothers was, wasn't there a group of African Americans pretending to be friends but slowing things down, causing trouble in every city in the United States? Every one of them. Because I was in those days, I used to be on the road all day. I never was in Oakland. I was going from city to city to city all the time. Y'all remember that? And everywhere I went, I said, hey man, these brothers is real funny acting. They up next. And they, since I was African American, they thought I was like them. Yeah man, we got to get money from these Iranians and these Shiites, man. I said, I thought you were Shia. Hey man, I do what I got to get the money. You know, I said, oh, okay. So for the fitna that's been going on, don't let nobody tell you how bad you are. You've done very well so far. We just gotta do better. So that's my answer.
Thank you.
For the U.S. and Canada.
So,
yes.
Yeah. So we will have about 30 seconds for the questioner and 1 minute to a maximum 1.30 seconds for the for the panelists. So we'll go from this side. We had one question on this side. We'll go with it. One question on that side. So if you have a lady, that'll be good. One on the right, one on the left.
Assalamu alaikum. I would like to just to know a little more about Code Pink, what it is about.
Code Pink. What's Code Pink and how did you choose that color, huh?
So very briefly, Code Pink started when George Bush declared the color-coded alert system, code yellow, orange, red, to keep us in a constant state of fear and justify violence. Code Pink was meant to be an alternative, go after the people who attacked us on 9/11. Let's remember 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudis, and not use it as an excuse to invade other countries. And you can find more out about us by signing up at CodePink.org online, and we'll also have a sign-up sheet at the book table afterwards. Thank you.
Yeah, if anybody is not a member of Code Pink, please become one. We need to support them.
We have a question here.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
So my name is keep an idea of who is asking. So.
Yeah. My name is Sayyid Khurshid Ali. I am from Dearborn, Michigan, and my question is to Sister Benjamin. The question is that. You have a book on Saudi Arabia and apparently indicating some relationship between U.S. and Saudi Arabia that is undesired, and Brother Imam Musa indicated a relationship which is evolving and it is going in a direction which probably may Saudis may be dumped out. What is your take on that perception that he has presented?
Well, I think the Iran nuclear deal marked a real important moment when the U.S. Did something that neither the Israelis nor the Saudis wanted them to do. But I would say we're still far from a split with the Saudis. The original Saudi dependence was on oil. The U.S. is not so dependent on Saudi oil anymore. As Iman Musa said, it's really a lot of it is around the weapon sales now with $97 billion worth of weapons. But I would say even more important is that we as U.S. citizens have allowed this relationship to go on and that it's really up to us to start exposing it. I mean, you look at Hillary Clinton and the Clinton Foundation getting millions of dollars from the Saudi government and we allow that to happen instead of saying that that should be illegal. So I think there are still way too many ties. There's 8 different lobby groups that the Saudis have hired in Washington, D.C. They spend many millions of dollars every month on trying to put a positive spin on Saudi policies and U.S.-Saudi relations. They hire Democratic lobby groups, Republican lobby groups. So there is a lot that we still have to do.
Does any of the sisters have a question? If not, we'll just pass them.
The volunteers are looking at who's next.
Yeah, okay. Ali Musa from New Jersey. Imam Musa talked about death to America and went on to explain that it doesn't mean death to the American people, but to the American policies, per se. Now, whenever we speak to non-Muslim Muslims and talk about Iran, they immediately make this slow slogan and they get their desired effect as such. Even when we are returning the $400 million back to the country who gave us that money, people are saying they're going to use us $400 million to cause death to America. So my question to both of you is that this slogan is, would you desire this slogan to have been a little bit more clearer than it is? And I would like to know from Medea the impression the non-Muslims get from the slogan.
Well, it's a terrible slogan, and we should never use the slogan, and we should tell people who use it to never use the slogan. No matter how it's meant to be interpreted, just think about what it sounds like. And I think it's important that we be careful in the words that we use and the slogans that we have. But a point that you brought up about the $40 million, and at this point in the electoral season, it's really interesting because it's really forcing Hillary Clinton to embrace the Iran deal and be defending the administration on this. Before, I think she would have distanced herself more from this. So in a sense, it could be seen as a positive thing, and that the Republicans are trying to use this to attack Obama and Hillary Clinton, and Hillary Clinton is suddenly saying that she was negotiating and helped to bring about the Iran nuclear deal when she was just the opposite. She was always putting the military option on the table. So let's use this moment to keep pushing her further to embrace not only the Iran nuclear deal, but to take military options off the table.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The global environment is not the same as it was during the early years of Mark Bagamnika, Death to America. That slogan arose out of the 25 years. In 1953 or 1951, the people of Iran put the Shah out, right? And 2 years later, they brought the Shah back. And the people of Iran had to suffer around 25 or 26 years of that brutal regime. It was the United States that engineered, it was the first coup by the United States. The next one was Guatemala, 54. But that was the first, so the Iranian people are responding to the slaughter and murder by the United States government and all of its policies over those decades. So it was an environment of death to America. It was not death to the American people, but death to its policies and death to that system. The world is not like it was then. Saudi Arabia is not as protected as it was before. It spends millions and billions, but like you say, if 13 of the hijackers, or how many so-called 13, 15 from Saudi Arabia, right? If they were going out doing lap dancing the night before, then those guys had nothing to do with Islam, isn't that right? Okay, if Boko Haram that captures young girls and imprisons people, if Daesh and ISIL
slaughter Christians, Zaydis, and everybody else, right? Then Saudi Arabia is the perpetrator of all of this fitna, and the American people are beginning to find out the 28 pages that they all want to see, right? All of this stuff is changing. It's not an overnight, but the environment is totally different than it was 10 or 15 years ago with Saudi relationship and with American relationship. And remember, when it's time to go, America always dumps whoever it's time to go. They're gonna dump you, okay? And it looks like the reason Saudi Arabia is in a panic, the reason Netanyahu is going crazy also, is because they feel that Iran is the power center in the Middle East. And guess what? It is. That's the reality. Okay? And I don't want to take too long, but remember, Allah was on the side of Iran. You got to remember, Saddam caused the war and did all of that. But guess what? Iran didn't have to get rid of Saddam. The United States came and got rid of him for Iran. Iran didn't fire a shot. Isn't that right? So it looks like the whole thing that's gelling looks like it is going our way. As we said, we should take advantage of the situation and help educate people on what's really going on and what possibilities there are for peace and entering into the mid part of this century with global harmony. It goes like this. We have to save this world and make it habitable for animals, people, and we have to take and put a check on the main predator. The main predator is the human being. Some kind of way we got to put the human being in check, because if we keep on going the way we're going, it's not saving the Sunnis or the Shias or the Afghans or the world. And I'll finish with this. You know, if you go into Europe, just say out in the ocean is 3,000 miles. If you have trouble with your boat at 1,000 miles, you can turn around and go back. But if you get 1,600 miles, you're past the point of no return. If we keep allowing money to rule the earth, they will make it uninhabitable. And we'll go past the stage where the world, the earth, which is a living organism, can rejuvenate itself. It's more than just political. It's about life on this planet as we know it. That's what this 21st century is about.
Thank you. And we'll wrap up with the last question.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. So in regards to what the first brother said of the hadith, in regards to when Muslims migrate, they should stand with the oppressed and stand against the oppressor. In regards to your answer, you know, we're not doing bad. Obviously, we have conferences like this, alhamdulillah, where we are, you know, speaking truth to power. From my experience personally in the community of San Diego, I think Imam Mahdi himself would get banned from some of the centers we have for being what it's called too political. We tried to do Quds Day, just a presentation on boycotting Israel, you know, and actually in that process we discovered some fatwa from Sistani and Khamenei about why it is incumbent upon the believer to do. You can't boycott everything, but do the best you can. You know, Coca-Cola, we can live without Coca-Cola. We wanted to educate about that. We were banned from having such a presentation at our masjid. We had to go to another masjid to do it. But they won't let us have Quds Day. They'll invite an FBI agent to come to that same masjid and then try to recruit children to be spies for them, which is crazy. And then, for example, in New York, you had a press conference with the NYPD instead of press conference with the victims of the NYPD's police brutality. What can we do to really change this? Because if Shias are supposed to, you know, be this kind of example for the Muslim community and for the rest of the world, for the rest of, you know, our fellow Americans to stand up for what's right, stand up for constitutional civil liberties and everything like that. How can we do this if we're standing with the oppressor instead of with the oppressed?
Yeah.
I have found in the interactions that I've had with Muslim communities that oftentimes they're very conservative and very fearful, not wanting to join us in a lot of the political activities that we're organizing. Sometimes they'll come out around the Israel-Palestine issue, but not open to coming out around a lot of the other kinds of protests that we've been organizing. I'm anxious to break that in the next administration, because I think we will all fail if we don't start finding more ways to work together and get over the fear and find our inner courage and force our own communities, and you in the Muslim community to force your own community to stop hiding your heads in the sand. And, you know, either we will all go down together and we'll get another kind of Japanese internment kind of program where Muslims will be sent away, or we'll stand up courageously together. And I look forward to the latter, because I think the community is starting to feel that standing up every time there's a terrorist act and saying, it's not us, it's not our community, Islam is a peaceful religion, we didn't do it, that's getting old, that's getting tiresome. We have to stand up together. I'm sick of these press conferences where every Muslim leader has to come up and say the same thing. So really, it is up to us, but I do think then it's going to require some hard work together on some very difficult issues for your community. And excuse me for bringing up some of those hard issues that we might not agree on, we don't agree on, we may never agree on, we can agree to disagree on them, but when you bring up who is oppressed in the community, certainly we could agree that we should work against poverty. If you say that Islam is a feminist religion, then we have to work to make sure that women get equal pay for equal work and things like that. But I do think we have to be supportive of the Black Lives Matter community, because if we believe in justice, we have to recognize the injustice in the Black community. But I will also bring up the gay rights community, because I think that is a community that's suffering a lot of oppression, and I know it's a very sensitive issue in your community, but I feel like I have to bring that up, because when you talk about who is under attack at this point, it's also that community. The immigrant rights community, the Latino community, I think we can make a lot more joint work together with that. And lastly, I do want to say that I think there is a very positive way that we can work together with the environmental community. I think from a religious standpoint, and what the Imam just said, recognizing that we might not have a planet in the future unless we work on that issue together, is something that can unite us as well.
When you're working for the cause of Allah, you have to have a protracted, a long range, even in the revolutionary days. You realize struggle is a long range process. You have to have a lot of patience. And you have to have patience with yourself, and you have to have patience with others. After every revolution, there's during the time of Imam, everybody's on the line of Imam, moving straight ahead, no problem. Because we're in a war, we don't have time to differentiate too much. So everybody's toeing the line. Now you don't have that same thing. If you want to look for Black Lives Matter, say from Iran, you look on the Rahbar's website, and guess what you see? You see me there talking with expertise on the Black Lives Matter. We have people that don't even support Velayati Faqih. Have you noticed the difference between the leadership and what he says and what happens as it goes down, as it's translated in action? It's different. Why is it different? Because we have many very good people, but they believe in, I said it at Anjuman years ago. I said, if you work in a sewer all your life, I said, when you come home, you can't smell yourself, but everybody else can because you work in a sewer, right? Okay. I said, that's the way politics is. Many of our, the diplomacy, I said the word diplomacy. From the top, you look at the Rahbar's pronunciations and all of his guidance and everything. It's absolutely correct. This is just my belief. But when it's translated, when it gets to us, it ain't like that. It is diluted along the way through different perspectives. That's what's happening now. It's getting better right now. And that peace deal was one of the good things because people were jumping up and down about America. We told the people, you know, the white man told the Indians, he broke so many treaties, but one of the big lies he told, they said, a great white father, how long is this treaty? First of all, General Crook or somebody that's making the treaty, when it gets back to the White House, the Congress is different. And they send all the Apaches to Florida and send all the Seminoles and everybody else through the Trail of Tears and the Cherokees to Oklahoma. So we know when you make a treaty or a compromise with America, they always lie. They can't help it. That's in their, I don't want to say it's genetic, but America lies all the time. It's the part of the system. And it's set up so, oh, the State Department signed all of that with Iran. But that don't have nothing to do with me and you. We're the Congress and the Senate. Isn't that right? Or they can say something real stupid, like most of the people are from Saudi Arabia, that, right, that was so-called 9/11, but we're going to give $11 billion of Iran's money, right, for the so-called 9/11. It's insanity. So what I'm saying is, you haven't seen me speak at any Imam Mahdi Center or anything. Only center I've spoken at in the last decade is right here in Detroit. Have you seen me anywhere else? I used to be just the darling of, you know, I was everywhere. What happened? Things quieted down. That rhetoric is not needed now by them. Our homeboys, our friends, the in-betweens. The in-betweens that actually subvert the policy of the Rahbar. Do you see what I'm trying to tell you? That in between, the Rahbar said, hey, let's get out, hit the streets. But then there's people in between. If you knew the fitna, do you know how comfortable the ulama in Qum is about, the Rahbar calls it Nufuzi, right? Nufuzi infiltrators, kind of like saboteurs and like that, isn't that the word? But then he said, those regular infiltrators are all right, but he says, I don't know the word, Jarayan Nafuzi, the organized saboteurs, infiltrators, right?
The Rahba speaks about that all the time. That's a reality. With all the fitna that's happening, we're doing very, very well. And just for you to not be welcome, if I told you the treatment that we go through, you would start crying. You would say, why are they so optimistic? It's because we've seen it all before. We've seen it during the Black Movement, the African Liberation Movement, civil rights. All of it has a pattern. No matter how bad you feel, we are doing pretty good compared to what we're dealing with.
Thank you. Thank you. With all this food for thought, we have a good appetite now. The lines are short, so our lunch will be quick.